Hello and welcome to the CGF Sustainability Podcast Series. My name is Louise Chester and I work in the communications team at the Consumer Goods Forum, and this is the latest episode in our new series, which will take a deep dive into all things sustainability, from forced labour to plastics, deforestation, food waste and refrigeration. Our industry has a clear responsibility to address these issues, and we hope that this series will give you a little insight into the key players working behind the scenes to tackle the challenges facing our industry and the planet. Today, I'm joined by Nick Gleischer, Chief Operating Officer at the Thomson Reuters Foundation. Nick is a lawyer by trade who moved into the development sector 9 years ago. I'm really interested to talk to Nick about his work at the foundation and get his thoughts on how we can best tackle the very important global issue of forced labour. Hi, Nick. Thank you so much for joining me today on the podcast.
That's my pleasure. It's very exciting to be here.
Great. So let's dive straight in. I'd like to find out a little bit more about you and your profile. Do you think that you could start by telling our listeners a bit about yourself and how you got involved with this field of work?
Yeah, sure. No worries at all. So I'm a lawyer by training and was a finance and banking lawyer at one of the US firms in the city here in London in my past life. And my intention in going into law was that I wanted to have a skill to work in the development sector. And I think I just wanted to make sure that when I joined the sector, I would be of use. And so embarked on a career in law and woke up one morning as a structured finance lawyer and realized I drifted a little bit away from my initial goal. And roughly at that sort of time, trust law at the Thomson Reuters Foundation was just launching. It's a global legal pro bono service. And they launched without any lawyers in place. And within a couple of months, realized that actually to run a legal pro bono platform, you really do need a lawyer there. And as I was beginning to look around and trying to work out how to refocus my career onto the development sector, this amazing opportunity popped up at the foundation to come in as a manager and help lead this nascent pro bono service. And that was 9 and a bit years ago now.
Super, super. And you missed out one very important point there, and that is actually that we sort of went to the same school, Merchant Taylors. That was the very beginning of your journey towards saving.
That was the beginning of my journey. We did go to the same school, but in different parts of the country, the complicated Merchant Taylors system. But yes, yeah. Yes, school fellows.
Indeed. So at the CGF, a huge part of what we do, especially within the Social Sustainability Initiative, is to foster and promote collective action between government, civil society, and on-the-ground initiatives. So I would like to hear from you what you believe is the role of lawyers in sustainability and how you fit into the equation.
My view would be that every single sustainable solution to social problems has law at its core. And that may sound like a very grand claim, but actually every single sustainable solution, every idea that is gonna last for a long time needs to be embedded into a legal framework. And whether that means that making sure that the organizations that have agreed to work together are working together in the way that they agreed, that you have proper functioning partnerships, that you have commercial arrangements that work, or whether it's looking at embedding new ideas into policy, looking at legislative change to have a ongoing social impact, or even helping people understand their rights and looking at the way that they can enforce their rights within the framework that they're living in. All of those are the bedrock of any long-term solution.
Yeah, totally.
Legal provision is at its core. Like I can't think of a situation, and I have been racking my brain about this because this is my job, is looking at where law intersects with the impact economy. And so this is something that I look at and think about, and I've yet to come up with a decent example of something that does not require a legal underpinning. And it's a shame, and I've seen firsthand the amazing impact that of legal provision has had on the lives of local communities, local populations, the environment, just how important it can be in raising the impact in social initiatives.
Do you have a concrete example to share?
Yes, again, where to start? There's lots and lots of examples I can give. There's ranging from, there was one organisation that we worked with many moons ago when I first started at the Thomson Reuters Foundation. We were working with a small social enterprise in Colombia who focuses on reforestation. And they had an arrangement with a car manufacturer in Colombia to make all of the cars sold in the Colombian market carbon neutral. Mm-hmm. Come up with a complicated framework, a measurement framework, where they'd be planting a certain number of trees in the Amazon rainforest per car. And this relationship had been going on for a little while, and they were renegotiating for a second phase of the relationship. And this social enterprise was negotiating with a car company and was sitting around a table, and it was the founder of this company was opposite a suite of lawyers that had been flown down from New York, the largest law firm in Colombia, a handful of senior executives were the other side of the table trying to negotiate with him. And these guys came to us and said, can you help with our negotiations? And we found a local law firm to help them. And as the negotiations progressed, rather than it being a founder social entrepreneur that was representing himself by himself, we ended up bringing in the second largest law firm in Colombia. And suddenly, having a legal support sitting next to you means that negotiations suddenly start becoming far more equitable. The environmental impact of this transaction suddenly leapt up and became far more significant. And that's just by having a knowledgeable and comfortable legal negotiator sitting next to you, let alone looking at far more complicated things like law change and the impact that has on local populations.
Fantastic. Thank you for sharing that example. So I also want to talk about the Stop Slavery Award, as I know that you developed and managed the award scheme. So maybe you could tell our listeners a bit about what it is and how it drives impact for the industry.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the Thomson Reuters Foundation looks for different ways to try and bring together different actors, different agents, different organizations in different parts of society, parts of the economy, to look at how they can use their skills to have a positive impact. The idea of the Stop Slavery Award was to try and create a platform through which corporates would be able to highlight the good work that they're doing to try and limit the risk of slavery in their supply chains and operations. We're very, very well aware that it's impossible to claim that you are 100% slave-free as an organization. Yeah. But there are lots of organizations that are doing really, really good work. And the only outlet that had previously existed, as far as we were aware, for this was journalism and news, which by and large was hammering these organizations for saying that there are slaves in their supply chain. There was no positive outlet to try and raise the profile of the amazing work that was being done. And that was the genesis of the Stop Slavery Awards, was to try and work out what we can do to give organizations a platform. And in order to create the awards, we designed a really comprehensive questionnaire with the idea being that nobody would be able to answer yes to all of the questions, and nobody would be able to demonstrate exactly that they are perfect in everything that they're doing. But that if we can come up with a best practice questionnaire, it will not only help us understand how corporates are progressing on their journey as they're trying to limit the risk of slavery, but it would also help signpost a new direction for organizations that are looking for a better understanding of what they can do to try and have this great social impact. So we launched the awards 3 years ago, and we've had a great response to the awards.
Well, that really resonates with us, as we do see that some of our members are often rather reticent to speak out about this issue. So I think that, as you say, providing that space for positive empowerment is definitely the way to go.
Yeah, I understand why organizations are reticent. I get that. And as I mentioned earlier, I'm a lawyer, so I'm risk averse. So I completely understand why it is a difficult decision to stand up and hold yourself up as an organization that is leading the way in trying to the risk of slavery occurring within the sphere that you control, particularly because it is impossible to completely eradicate. And it means that the organizations that are being brave and holding themselves up and saying, yeah, we're trying to fix this, are the ones that it then becomes easiest to criticize. Being able to reward the bravery that organizations show in standing up and holding themselves up as leaders in this space. For us, it's amazing to see, and it's amazing the efforts that some of these organizations are putting into their operations and the way that they work to try and have a positive impact here.
Mm-hmm. So could you share some examples of any good practices that you've seen emerging from companies who've been involved with the Stop Slavery Awards?
Yeah, I think there's lots of different things that companies do that put them up there as leading organizations in the space. Some of them are really simple. The fact that the UK now has the Modern Slavery Act and that there is a requirement to report on what you are doing to try and stop slavery from occurring in your supply chains and the way that you interact with that issue as it arises means that it's actually quite easy now for companies to adhere to the Modern Slavery Act and thereby show that they are leading the way. One of the things that the Slavery Act encourages and that we see lots of organizations don't quite follow is the fact that the Modern Slavery Act statement should be signed off by a senior executive. Having C-suite management engaged in this issue, I think, makes you a market leader, because there are lots of organizations that don't do that.
Absolutely. Mm.
And there are a handful of other relatively straightforward things that can be done as well. Looking at training, I think, is important. And again, it's one of those things that seems to be forgotten by many organizations. Making sure that when instances of slavery are discovered in the businesses of suppliers or third-party organizations as well, not abandoning them is definitely something that we see that most market leaders are now pursuing. The best practice would definitely not be to just drop them, because the impact on the individuals that are enduring forced labor is more than likely that they'll lose their jobs and end up in another forced labor situation. Far better would be to devote resources to trying to rectify and improve the business practices within this third-party organization, which requires a whole range of different skills, from soft diplomacy to actually being able to run training courses for third parties.
So you would say then that there are sort of common factors or trends that you see amongst the companies who do seem to be succeeding in this fight against forced labor?
Yeah, definitely. There 100% are. There's a handful of really common traits, and you can normally tell them quite quickly from speaking to people that work in the teams that deal with these sorts of issues.
I personally think that companies that have seen success in trying to suppress forced labor in their supply chains are mostly the ones who started to work with their industry.
Absolutely. I think it's really important that organizations work together across their industry. And it's not just across their industry. I think that there's an awful lot that can be learned from engaging with NGOs, organizations on the ground, even police and enforcement agencies, speaking to local government, municipality type organizations, to understand the different practices that are in place and the different initiatives that are being developed. But thinking about the way that industries are coming together, there are more and more industry groupings. And for me, the idea of having these pre-competitive groups of people, organizations that normally are sitting the opposite end of the table, suddenly sitting next to each other and looking at how they can share best practice, how they can share their learnings, and how they can ensure that they're operating in a joined up way so that they can try and use their collective muscle to have an influence in the markets that they're working in the supply chains that they're working in. To me, it's obvious, and I'm frustrated that this wasn't thought of years and years ago, that people have taken a while to cotton on to how this can be used in forced labor. But it's crucial. And the only way that we're going to be able to have a sustained impact is if we do have companies coming together within the same industry and projecting an industry standard that everyone needs to adhere to if they want to sell services into those industries.
So what do you think then, Nick, about initiatives such as the CGF's priority industry principles? How do they help to drive this progress?
I think they're hugely important. They're really, really important. And there's lots of different reasons why I think that. There's lots of different levels to it. But broadly, there are lots of organisations that don't really know where to start. And this is a big issue. This is an issue where realistically people have to look at the way that they've been working, the way that they do business, and start thinking about how to reframe it, taking into account something that up until 10 years ago, no more than that, was a hidden and almost sort of accepted issue. So things like the priority industry principles, I think, have been so important in giving companies a base standard that they can hold on to. That here is an entry level, here is a collection of principles that if you adhere to, then you are on that journey. Like this is a way that you can enter into this space and move forward from here. And so I think it's hugely, hugely important. The idea of these sorts of aspirational principles and the fact that it's peer companies coming together, it's these companies that would otherwise be competing, agreeing that there is a line that they are all going to adhere to, that will help support and prop up the efforts of organizations all over the world that are looking at forced labor and trying to combat it, is amazingly important. And the fact that it then becomes a launch pad to look at, to drilling down onto a much more granular level, to try and work out how to embed the different principles that all sit at a much higher level, is an incredibly important way to do it. And as all collections of companies are aware, getting people to agree on things is very, very difficult. It's surprisingly difficult, but to come up with some wording that you can say, right, I'm going to follow this. This is going to be the starting point for what I do. And I'm going to use these as the basis of the way that I reframe and review how I'm going to do business. I think it's key. I don't want to go wax lyrical too much about it, but honestly, I think these sorts of principles are a cornerstone of all of the activity that's happening worldwide on it, and I can't praise them enough.
Absolutely. And for anyone who is interested, we do have a guidance booklet on implementing the priority industry principles available on our website. So Nick, I wanted to know if you could offer any advice to our members who are on the pathway to eradicating forced labor. What would it be?
So I think I would propose three bits of advice, none of which are that straightforward to follow, I appreciate. But the bits of advice I would propose are, picking up on what I mentioned earlier, be persistent. If you have a new idea, if you have a new program, a new initiative that you start and you don't have immediate results, be persistent, stick with it. As I say, a lot of these things take time. Culture takes time to change. It takes time to find all of your suppliers and look into your supply chains. It takes time to understand your own business world. So be persistent. I think as a second bit of advice, I would say be transparent. Nobody is perfect. Nobody has a entirely slave-free supply chain. And I think being transparent about the challenges that organizations are having and the challenges that they're having, not only in grappling with these issues, but also in embedding a culture that acknowledges that forced labor should be a core part of what they're looking at. Transparency internally within the organization and externally, standing up and saying, hey, we found a problem and we're working really hard to fix it. I think that is going to be a way that we will help change the perspective on forced labor, that will help change social norms around it. And rather than ending up with a knee-jerk blaming culture, we'll end up with a culture of looking for ways to find solutions. So to me, transparency is another really important element that we need to be encouraging. And then lastly, I would say we need companies to be willing to accept imperfection. I'm aware that companies are forced to do everything they can for shareholder value, that they're forced to find quick solutions, that the level of inspection on the amount or on the kind of the financial value of companies, and there's so much information out there about companies and how they're performing. It means that there is a culture of perfection. And within companies, all the staff are trying to make sure that everything they do is at a level of perfection. Whereas acknowledging forced labor requires an acknowledgement that you are not perfect, that the way that you've organized your company is not perfect, that there are hidden issues that you have to just accept that they will come up and that there's not much you can do about it. But being willing to accept that you are imperfect, that your supply chain and your operations may be imperfect, is hugely important in helping drive this space forward and helping make sure that there is a better lot for people that are at risk of or victims of forced labor, that we can have open conversations, that we can look for solutions whilst being honest and open about it. This idea of imperfection, I think, is really important. And there's too many companies out there that would rather stay silent about it and not acknowledge that they are imperfect than open up and be transparent and put themselves out there saying, yes, we've got some problems that we're looking at. And so I would really strongly encourage a willingness to accept imperfection as well.
Super. Yeah, all of your points are so, so pertinent, especially this idea of perfection, which I know we spoke about earlier. Thank you. Absolutely solid advice there. So one final question, and this is something I like to ask everybody who comes on the podcast. What keeps you inspired and motivated to keep working in this field? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
A big question. So I'm really passionate about this field. Like I think that there is so much power in the corporate sector, and if we can harness that power to try and have a positive social impact with it, it would be so easy to change the world really quickly. So for me, like I'm so passionate about looking for ways to try and encourage the corporate sector to do more. And whether that's through social entrepreneurship, whether that's encouraging mission-led businesses, whether it's looking at human rights and forced labor within supply chain, looking at impact investments or social investment, there's lots of different ways that we can leverage the corporate world to have a positive social impact. And this is the thing that I love. Like I'm so fortunate that I get to spend my days looking at ways and designing initiatives and projects that enable us to do that. And so for me, just knowing that this is what I'm going to be working on is sort of my reason to get up in the morning. I'm one of those quite lucky, slightly smug people that actually jobs. So that's enough for me. It's harnessing that power. It's there's so much potential there, and there's so much opportunity, and it's I love it.
Great. Yeah, that definitely sounds like enough to get you leaping out of bed in the morning.
That said, I'm not really a morning person, so it's more until I've had my first cup of tea. But
yeah, you start the day in double digits.
Yeah.
10 a.m. onwards. Well, thank you so much. That was such an interesting chat.
That's my absolute pleasure. It's been really nice to speak to you.
If you'd like to find out more about the CGF's work on sustainability, you can visit our website, www.theconsumergoodsforum.com. If you liked this episode, make sure to subscribe to the podcast for new episodes coming very shortly. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.